now our feature presentation.
Welcome to the Movie Goings Podcast, Episode 7. I'm your host, Jared Wheeler.
And I'm your co-host, Michael Wheeler.
So today we're going to be talking about King Kong, the original King Kong from 1933. And since this was my pick, Micah, you go first.
Okay, so I mean, who hasn't heard of King Kong? No, not the Peter Jackson version, but I did see that long before I saw this version. This is actually my first viewing last night. And
you're welcome.
Yeah. Thank you. No, but I did enjoy it. I couldn't help but continually sort of see Peter Jackson's version in my mind as I was watching this version, which I think you're definitely going to argue is a tragedy. It's just the fact.
No, I don't think I would say it that strenuously. Because I don't feel like his version ruins this one or anything like that, or that it diminishes it in any way. Or, I mean, obviously, the cat is out of the bag. I'm not a big fan of his version.
Right. But I was, just to clarify, I just was surprised by how similar. I mean, it's the same movie, but obviously Peter Jackson's is, you know, lengthens every
three
scene
hours
by
long.
Many, many times. So, yeah, much
versus
longer.
An hour and 20 minutes, which, you know, we're recording this in 2015, so everybody has seen his Hobbit trilogy by now, and it's not a big surprise to anyone.
I haven't seen it.
Stretches things out to an absurd degree. Well, good for you.
I'm avoiding it, though.
You know, this is a decade on from his remake, I think that you can see in this remake kind of the seeds of what his weaknesses are as a filmmaker. He has a lot of strengths, certainly. I don't want to diminish him completely, because his Lord of the Rings trilogy was, you know, in like my top three movies of the decade, for last decade. But I think that when he has a lot of money and a lot of passion and kind of like nerdiness directed at a particular project, excess
things
is
go
kind
wrong.
Of the way he goes. So,
well,
but
and
yeah,
just
his version, if you've seen his version, is basically a scene for scene remake of this, with one notable exception, which we can talk about in a second.
Yeah.
This, the original is just so streamlined and just simple and perfect, and, you know, an hour and 45 minutes shorter than the Jackson version. And, you know, you watch his version and you're just like, well, you didn't improve. I guess he made it more exciting and more adrenaline packed, I guess, for some people. But I don't think that it works that way. What do you think?
I think
was what he was going for. He think he was trying to update it for a modern audience and take the things that he loved and just punch them up some more and give them even more adrenaline. All the action scenes that he adored when he was a kid, just extrapolate those out to the nth degree.
Well, we've talked about this in relation to his Hobbit trilogy, which I haven't seen the whole trilogy. I've only seen the first movie, but we've talked about, you know, there's a good Hobbit movie in there, and I think that there's a good Kong movie in his version. It just
there is
needs
a good
to
Kong
be
movie
subtracted
it's
by
the
like an hour,
one, right?
Right. Like, yeah. Exactly. And I think he does some things. So he chose, you know, obviously he has a lot more. He has the ability to make these incredible special effects that, of course, like, you know, how many was it? Is it like 70 years later? Of course, like he has access to a lot of that. But what he chooses to do with it a few times, I think most the biggest decision that he made in this movie, which, you know, we've talked a little bit about this prior to making this podcast. But, you know, the relationship between Anne and Kong, I think he does a much better job with, but I don't know that I can say better. It sounds like when they were making the original King Kong, they didn't realize that that relationship was going to be something that people sympathized with, or, you know, would
that
try
the
to understand.
Would be something that people sympathize with, because
this
is at its heart kind of a monster movie. And I want to go into that more in a second for sure. But yeah, I think what he does, he is a supreme craftsman, with an immense amount of technical skill, and I've said many times that he has some of the best people in the world working for him, in terms of visual effects and production design and just artistic abilities. So
undoubtedly, you know,
it's just going to look incredible. And this is this question of what's behind it and what's driving it, and that's kind of what he brings to it, and it's not always what I would say what it should be. But yeah, so like I was telling you, the one scene in this scene-for-scene remake, which is not in the original Kong, is the spider pit sequence, which, as you said, is very hard to watch.
Yeah.
He's just like, ah!
He just goes on and on and on. It's just horrible.
Yes, it is. And there was, this is, you know, this was a scene that was in the original movie, but it was removed before the film was screened. Probably destroyed, and so it's become this kind of legendary thing that fans of Kong have always wanted to get their hands on, but it probably doesn't exist anymore.
Wait, you know, destroyed,
Jack
Jones,
he
said?
Wanted to do his version of that. Yes, he probably destroyed it. So Jackson definitely, you know, wanted to do his own version of that and stick it in there. And he actually did, around the time he was remaking Kong, he actually made like a 1933 version of the sequence, and just to see how it would look, basically, and it's interesting to watch, but it doesn't really do much. And for a long time, the director of the original said that the scene was cut because it was just too horrifying, and it just would have disturbed audiences too much. And I think seeing the scene in the remake, you can suspect that might actually be true. But the real reason, which he revealed later on, was that it just wasn't good for the flow or the pacing of the movie. It just kind of stops the story dead without adding anything or subtract. Like, there's no reason for it to be there. So it was cut out, which is a smart filmmaking decision. And I think it's the kind of decision that I haven't seen Jackson know how to make. He doesn't ever take things away. He only adds things on. And that's not always the way to make a good movie or tell a good story. So I think that kind of exemplifies one of his weaknesses as a filmmaker, just the idea that, oh, we could have this cool spider pit sequence, and never mind that it's totally irrelevant and totally out there and just kind of stops the flow of the movie. We're just going to dump it back in there because it's cool, and I'm geeking out about this, you guys.
Well, I mean, he's kind of like, you know, the kid in the candy shop with $100 in his pocket.
Right.
He just doesn't even know what to do with himself, and so he just, like, gets everything in sight.
His enthusiasm, and to hear him talk about King Kong, his enthusiasm for it is just really infectious. He adores this movie, and it, you know, it's really great to hear him talk about it. But you know, I just think that it doesn't translate as effectively when you're just kind of like, let's do everything we can and let's make the action scenes 20 minutes instead of 1 minute, and just like, it's gonna be awesome.
It just becomes
exhausting after a while.
And I don't want to spend really much of any more time talking about that version of Kong. And I haven't gotten around to asking you why you chose this movie.
Well, yeah, I saw Peter Jackson's version first, although I didn't see it in theaters when it was first released. I can't remember exactly why that was, but I just eventually got around to seeing it on DVD several years later, but still before I'd seen the original. And I was like, it's interesting, I guess. There's a lot of, like, I remember kind of just the mind-numbing action, just this, the fight with the T-Rex that goes on and on and on, and they're still punching each other and biting each other, and it just is interminable. And I finally, Brett, our brother, gave me a 2-disc special edition of King Kong, because he finds good deals on DVDs and gets them, and has a whole bunch, and just gives me some stuff that he thinks I'd be interested in every now and then, especially older stuff that he finds, because he's not that interested in it himself. So he gave it to me, and I was like, this is cool, I'll watch this. And I think it was over a Christmas break, and it was actually as I was planning a high school class on analysis of visual media, where I was going to be screening a lot of old movies. And so I ended up watching this and immediately thinking, I need to put this in to my syllabus, because I was so surprised by how much more engaged I was with this movie than I was with the 72 year later remake version, because it's streamlined, it's short, it just goes right for what it wants to do and then moves on. And I was also shocked by just how well the special effects were, because I expected them to be completely laughable, in every way. And, you know, they're dated, obviously, because it's the 30s. But
right.
I think that they hold up shockingly well. You really do. Like, if you can engage with the story, which I definitely can, and sit there and watch the movie, like, you will forget that you're watching, you know, stop-motion animation by the end. It's to me, anyway, it's not something that just is distracting throughout. Like, when the first time you see Kong, you're like, well, that doesn't look super realistic, but you forget, I think, by the end.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know, there were... I expected to laugh more than I did, if that makes sense.
Exactly.
The movie does draw you in, and you know, Jackson definitely holds on to like some of the horror aspects, although obviously elevates
them. Which is
kind
of his origins as a director.
Right, yeah. But I mean, they're there. They're unquestionably there. And I was surprised by like how effective some of the, everybody gets slaughtered at one point in the movie, and it's rough going, actually. It's not like, I don't know, it's cheesy on a certain level, because that's what it is, but at the same time, it's, I don't know, it's just surprising, that's all.
Yes, it is, I think that anybody now who watches it for the first time will be surprised by how well it holds up, because it's not kind of this relic that you would expect it to be. And, you know, when I was thinking about kind of its place in movie history, coming out in 1933, and I kind of mentioned to you last night when I was talking about that, when I was thinking about this, that maybe this is like the first great sound picture. And I was thinking about kind of some other early 30s movies, because I've mentioned to you before that silent film really advanced and developed and became very, very sophisticated by the late 20s. If you watch some silents from that era, they're just incredible works of art. And a lot of things that came in with sound kind of diminished movies for several years. If you watch some of the first sound movies versus some of the late silents, there's just a dramatic difference, and they're just not good. A lot of that has to do with the fact that the camera in early sound movies had to be inside of a soundproof booth, so they wouldn't get picked up by the mics, and so they couldn't move it around and do those big sweeping shots and things like they could in the silence. And so it was very confining, and there were just other technological constraints early on. And also they were just learning how to tell stories with sound where they'd been doing them in other ways for so long. So, you know, there's not a lot of great movies from this era compared to later on. But thinking about it, there are a few that stand out. There are a few Marx Brothers movies, I think four-ish, that came out during before King Kong, that are still considered classics. There's the original Dracula movie and the original Frankenstein movie. There's some of the first gangster films, Scarface, and what's the other one? Little Caesar with... his name is gone. Oh, I love this actor. Edward G. Robinson.
IMDb.
Edward G. Robinson. One of my favorite character actors. There's also All Quiet on the Western Front is a really great movie that won Best Picture in, I think, 1930. So all of these are really, really great early talkies that you could make an argument are some of the first great talkies. So you couldn't say King Kong is the first great talking movie. But what I think set King Kong apart, particularly from any of those movies, is that it's so original as a cinematic creation. The Marx Brothers were basically, you know, they have their own like franchise of movies that are built around their personalities, which were already established as stage personalities before they got into the movies. All the other movies that I mentioned, Little Caesar and Frankenstein and Dracula and All Quiet on the Western Front, those are all based on novels that already existed. And King Kong is a completely unique, original creation made specifically for the screen. There's no precedent for it in the literature. It was just visualized and born into the movies as was. It wasn't something that came from something before. And I think that makes it really special.
It's interesting. So, I don't know. I think, you know, I now we talk a lot about, man, why are they, you know, why are there so many sequels and why are there so many remakes? Why aren't there original movies? But I mean, I imagine that was, that's always been the case, that things have always been remade. Things have always been sort of recycled. So when something original comes around, it is special.
Yes. I mean, no, there are two remakes of King Kong. Neither of us have seen the 1970s version, so we're not really talking about that one. There was actually a sequel,
but it exists,
to the original King Kong called Son of Kong that came out a few years later, I want to say, that I haven't seen, and that, you know, it wasn't the success that King Kong was, and it hasn't lasted the way King Kong has lasted. But yeah, like, if you even talk about, if you want to talk about, you know, King Kong being super original and stuff, like, there are plenty of elements of King Kong that come from earlier things. Yeah, you want to, like, if you want to talk about, it was the first to do this, it was the first to do that, it was the first to do the other. There are little things that it was the first to do, and also it was the first to kind of combine a lot of previous elements into this massive success. But there was almost nothing new under the sun in movies, even as early as 1933. So, you know, that's definitely going to be a factor. But it still manages to do something really special and really unique and original with a bunch of things that had kind of been bits and pieces in other movies before.
What kind of reception did it get when it first came out?
It was a huge hit. It comes out at kind of the peak is the wrong word, you know, the opposite of peak, of the depression, when the country had basically
right. rocked the bottom. Lowest point.
And people, you know, came out in droves to see it. It was, you know, a massive success, and it continued to be something that was a massive, you know, like, it was re-released again in 1938, was a success again, and, you know, it has been re-released several times, I think, until, you know, home video and DVD and that kind of thing came along. Interestingly, it was when it was re-released in 1938, so it comes out in 1933, when it gets re-released in 1938, the major change that has happened in motion pictures is the production code has appeared, which makes certain things that were okay before now less okay. So there were actually 4 minutes, I think, roughly, of footage cut out of the movie at that point.
What?
One scene in particular was where Kong is undressing Fei Rei's character.
Of course.
That
yeah.
was snipped out. There were some kind of violent scenes where Kong is biting the head off of a native, or he has a native kind of in his jaws or whatever.
He's like that were stuffing him into the ground.
Yes. So those were gone and thought lost for a very long time. But it turns out that the guy who cut them out actually took them home with him and had them all those years. So they surfaced many years later. And then actually they ended up finding a pristine copy of it in the UK, because they didn't have the same level of censorship over there, so it survived. So you can watch those scenes restored now on any version that you get on DVD.
Yeah, which is what we've seen.
Right. So it's a movie that has, you know, undergone a couple of different changes due to changing standards. But anyway, yeah, it was still a success. But in terms of the stuff that it does really well, and stuff that it's kind of a pioneer in doing, in particular the special effects.
I was gonna say it'd have to be the special effects.
There are just so many amazing things that it does with the special effects, and we don't totally know exactly how they did some of those things still. They can figure it out, they can kind of piece it together, but a lot of the work with the monster was done with, you know, this little bitty model, basically, this little 18-inch model that was done with stop motion, obviously, because you can tell watching it that it's stop motion. But it was this tiny little model, and when they first released the movie with this whole subtitle of Kong, Eighth Wonder of the World, they didn't want people to know that the Eighth Wonder of the World was a foot and a half tall. So they obscured and hid a lot of the process that they had used to make the movie, and they actually released a lot of misinformation about how the effects were done as well. So
that's awesome.
So for a long time, people thought it was made one way, but it really wasn't, or people just thought, we don't know how this was made. And they used, yeah, just a wide variety of very sophisticated techniques to have this little bitty stop motion puppet essentially interacting in scenes with full-size humans that are supposed to be dwarfed by it. Everything from, you know, of course, there's a full-sized hand that they made that grips Fae Ray's character. Anne is her name, right?
Yes, Anne.
I should probably stop calling her Fae Ray. That grips Anne.
The actress.
And, yes.
Actually, they're both actresses, and so she, that's confusing.
Right, it is kind of confusing, but that's okay. Which is another thing that I love about this, by the way.
It's a movie about a movie,
which is such a great thing. Like, again, that's something that's so unique to this as an early film. Not that there aren't other films that are about films, but it being its own kind of original, made for the movie's creation, I love that they integrate movie making into the plot that way.
Into it. Yeah.
And I love that there are those scenes, like where he's doing the screen test, the director is doing the screen test with Anne on the ship, and it's kind of giving that little window into how directors work that audiences wouldn't necessarily know other than watching.
Anne, kind of like look up.
Behind the scenes.
Look up higher.
This is how,
now exactly. Higher still. Now look horrified.
This is how we make movies. Yes, now scream. Exactly.
Scream like your life depends on it.
She's doing the things even though there's nothing to scream about or whatever. Yeah. So I love all of that. Let's see. Where was I going with that? So we're talking about special effects. Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
So and what did you notice?
So, I mean, did they do anything new? Like, people had used models before, but it was like the combination of the models with the full-size hand along with
things.
The screen.
They combined a lot of techniques that had been used before but hadn't been combined before. There's this one special effects shot in particular that I've seen highlighted where he's got Anne up on a ledge in a little cave and he's standing down by like a lake and is it Jack is the male lead?
Yeah. Yeah.
He's kind of creeping in from the side and to get that shot, they had to have the set with the water and the matte painting in the back and the puppet with the stop motion, and then they have like some smoke and bubbling stuff going at the same time. And then to get the two humans into the shot, they have two little sections that have footage of the actual actors being projected in miniature next to all of the other miniatures, basically. So it's a marriage of a lot of different elements to make the thing look like it's happening. So there's a lot of stuff like that where they just did a lot of really ingenious things that are extremely difficult to pull off. And it ends up looking really great. Another thing that this movie does, there's the sound effects in the movie, which weren't really a thing in movies, obviously, too many years before, because in the silence you have no need for sound effects. And even, you know, in the early talkies, it's mostly just people talking, or maybe some glasses clinking, or people walking, or whatever. And in this, you have all of these fantastical sound effects, dinosaurs screeching, and
Stegosaurus, pterodactyls,
all these sorts of things.
Of course, Kong himself.
Yes, things that you can't just go out and record, but that you actually have to make up. And of course, it's not like they had to just come up with a way to do that out of nowhere, because there was radio, and radio sound effects were already a huge deal. It was the golden age of radio. But they had to bring in radio people to do this for their movie, which wasn't something that had really been done a lot in movies before.
Interesting. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yes, the stop motion, incidentally, the art of stop motion, the guy that they got to do the effects, his last name was O'Brien. Can't remember his first name, but he was a really, really big deal. You've heard of Ray Harryhausen, I assume.
Yes.
Yes. So Ray Harryhausen ended up basically was kind of this guy's apprentice many years later. And
what?
Went
That's
on
crazy.
To, yeah. Yes. So this is Ray Harryhausen's special effects father, basically.
Master.
And he did a lot of pioneering work with stop motion. He didn't invent stop motion. He wasn't the first person to do stop motion, but he did kind of independently come up with the process on his own. And he was doing it in, like, the teens. Like, Thomas Edison had commissioned him to do some stop motion films. And he had a whole series of them that he did throughout the teens and 20s. As he was kind of honing his craft and stuff. So he was a big stop motion guy that they pulled in to do this. And he was actually working on another film for RKO before Kong started, and it was this extremely ambitious idea for a movie, and they had already poured $100,000 into it, and you know, it was nowhere near complete. And a lot of elements of the plot actually resemble some of the elements of the plot of King Kong. And basically, the Depression hits, and the studio can't afford to finish this movie, and so they pull him off of it, and he ends up feeding a lot of those ideas and models and stuff that he'd already worked on into King Kong. Like, some of the dinosaurs in King Kong were already made for this previous movie that he'd been working on. So,
And right surely back. Wouldn't have been able to afford otherwise.
Right. Exactly. So, anyway, it was kind of like a happy marriage of various elements.
Of circumstances.
Right.
For Kong, so, anyway.
Right. Not so much for his
other movie. Own efforts.
Yeah. Yeah. So, anyway, yeah. So that's kind of the technical achievement that this movie is.
Is there anything, you know, there's one thing that I would note. I mean, it's not strange for a movie from this time, and I don't want to say really too much about it, but obviously with our modern sensibilities, the rampant like casual and not so casual sexism is just like crazy.
Yeah, sexism throughout. And racism.
Yeah,
and you know, it starts almost right away. The first mate on the ship, who's our hero, our male lead, is just like, there's no use for women on ships. Yeah. They're just completely useless, and they get in the way. And you know, you're all right, but you're useless. Sorry.
Okay, you're actually all right now, because I think I've fallen in love with you. But before right. then, didn't see much use for you.
Kind of a tool.
kind of.
And really, she is. I mean, you know, she's one of the first scream queens, I guess, as they were called many years later. Kind of these damsels of distress who spend most of the movie just kind of looking at a horrible monster and screaming their heads off.
And screaming,
waiting
yeah.
to be rescued.
Man, she probably drank her weight in lemon tea while making this movie, because she screams so much.
She's good. She's good at it, too. She's
yeah, she is. I mean, she'd have to be.
Right. But, yeah, definitely a lot of that going on, and it is what it is. You know, you say, with our modern sensibilities, I mean, there's still a lot of that kind of sexism in movies. It just gets called out more. Another element in this movie that stands out to me more is kind of the racial stuff that's going on. Obviously, there's the natives on the island who, you know, they see the white woman and they immediately want to make a trade for her, and that's supposed to be a horrible thing. And they come in, of course, and kidnap her and sacrifice her to Kong, who, you know, it's uncomfortable to say, but there is just this kind of thing of Kong's kind of ape-like nature, obviously being a monkey, and his blackness and his desire for a white woman. I feel like there's just a really uncomfortable racial subtext under all of that, and not buried super deep either.
No.
Did you, and I don't know, did that jump out at you at all? Because I do a lot of
well,
stuff
I have to admit,
this stuff jumps out at me.
I already had that from the Game of Charades in Inglourious Basterds.
Right, yes, of course.
So they make a big reference to that, and that for those of you who haven't seen Inglourious Basterds, but you know, one of them is trying to be King Kong, and the character guesses instead that you know, it's an American Negro. So yes, right. not hidden at all.
Well, Faye Ray was reportedly told by the director that before she knew anything about the plot of the movie, he told her she was going to have the tallest, darkest leading man in Hollywood. So she's like hoping for like a Cary Grant or a Clark Gable. And it's a giant ape.
So the director is, I mean, I wonder, was the director based at all off of the director character in the movie based at all after the real director?
Absolutely. before he got into fictional movies, this was a guy who was out in the field filming nature documentaries and, like, you know, getting up close to tigers and lions and other wild beasts with his camera. So definitely some autobiographical stuff there.
Yeah, and not to dissuade us from our previous topic. So, I mean, we're talking about jumping into, you know, potential themes for this movie, and certainly there's an undercurrent of racism that we don't want to just, like, run past.
Gloss over.
Yeah.
So it's there. I don't know how consciously it's there, at least with, I mean, definitely with the natives, but at least with Kong himself as a character, I don't know how conscious that is. But I think that it would be hard for an audience in the 30s to watch this not be concerned with, you know, the white woman in peril from the black ape, basically. Right. So, you know, it's there to kind of play on the audience's fears and prejudices, and I think that it, you know, it succeeds, obviously, at doing that.
Although it doesn't succeed, I don't think it ended up succeeding from what we were talking about earlier, as well as the director was, or others involved, thought that it would, in the sense of, you know, Kong ended up being just a much more sentimental character than they meant
him to be. It ends up succeeding better than they expected it to, right?
Well, that's if that was their intent, to make him sentimental at all.
Well, that's the thing. I don't think that... I don't know that they did. This is... You know, obviously we talked about Dracula and Frankenstein coming out before this, but this is one of the first, like, monster movies. And with both Dracula and Frankenstein, you've got guys in makeup, whereas this is a completely created thing. Probably... Well, certainly, if not the first, then the first really, really successful protagonist of a movie that doesn't actually exist. I mean, King Kong is a star, and he's, you know, just this completely made-up thing in the movie. He's not a guy in a suit or anything. He's just, like, a stop-motion character. Yeah.
Well, here's the thing, though. I think we were meant to take our cues from Anne, and we don't, because she spends the whole movie, there is no progression in her relationship with Kong. She spends entire movie screaming at him.
I mean, obviously we're going to sympathize with her and want her to be rescued, but we don't want to be her. She's helpless and screeches a bunch, like, you know, like, nobody wants to be
that person. Yeah. But what I'm saying is that I think we have a window potentially into...
You mean that we're supposed to be scared for her and we're not necessarily.
Yeah, we do feel sorry for Kong at the very least. And I don't know that we were originally meant to. Like, great, they ran with it because it happened. But I feel like it very easily could have happened in post-production or later.
Well, there was really no post-production at this point.
Oh, right. Okay, fair enough.
It's all kind of being done on the spot.
Production, but, and yeah, cut.
I think that, yeah, audiences were taken off guard, and maybe even the filmmakers themselves were caught off guard by how sympathetic Kong is. Well, I mean, how could you even plan for that, really? Because they're doing so many new things, and you don't know how he's going to turn out as a special effect. Is he going to be... Like, they want it, the first job is to make him look as real as possible, and O'Brien does so many great things with, like, just giving him a variety of facial expressions and, you know, just really pulling a soulful performance out of this puppet.
Inanimate object.
Like, how could anybody but him, anyway, have planned in advance that it would work out that way, or even conceived that that was possible?
I'm sure he would have wanted it, but who could have known that, that it was possible.
So, yeah, so that works extremely well. And so, yes, I you're right. So that does undercut, I guess, some of that racial issue in some ways, in that you end up feeling more sympathetic for King Kong, for the beast over the beauty. as
maybe,
the
maybe, maybe yes, maybe no, but that's, I don't know. I guess I have to wonder if it changes anything unless it was intentional.
Right. Well, it doesn't change anything in terms of
the film itself,
the intentions of the film, but it certainly has a big deal in terms of its impact and I think its longevity.
Yeah, and its experience. Yeah, the experience of watching it as well. The other theme, I mean, of course, that is stated almost from the beginning. I was really surprised that they I don't know if this is like a cat in the bag kind of situation, but they definitely let it out really very, very early in that, you know, the director in the first minute, I feel like, or 2 minutes, talks about, you know, oh yes, my movie is going to be about, you know, the, Beauty and the Beast and, you know, it opens with that quote unquote old Arabian proverb, which, by the way, is that a quote from the Quran?
I have no idea. And really there's no telling. It's
okay. I mean, they probably could have just made it up. Yeah.
Probably made.
Yeah. But about, you know, the moment that Beast saw Beauty, he was as one dead or something like that. So, I mean, they set that up from the beginning. So obviously the running theme of, you know, Beauty and the Beast and the fact, I don't know if, can we even call it like doomed love? It's very one-sided,
yeah,
for sure.
No, I think you can. You can certainly, it's what makes Kong a tragic figure in the movie, mm-hmm. basically. Because we don't really know a lot about, we know nothing about his origins. Apparently, the natives sacrifice women to him, and I assume that they have some idea that if they can sacrifice Anne to him, that would be better than the black women that they have been sacrificing to him, which is, again, kind of the racial thing. Mm-hmm. But obviously, you know, he grabs her, and I don't know kind of what to make of their relationship kind of at the get-go, but certainly his driving kind of force from pretty early on is just, like, to protect her. It's not super clear what he's going to do with her.
Yeah.
If she's not rescued.
There is...
Keep her around like a toy or something even more sinister. I mean, there's the scene where he kind of is pulling her clothes off, but it's not...
But I mean, it's curiosity.
Weird, but it's more like he... Yeah, exactly. He doesn't know what's, like... He hasn't seen...
It's like, what is
before.
This thing? At the same time, yeah, at the beginning, there is this sort of uncomfortably... I don't even know whether to call it lewd or not, but the expression that they have on Kong's face when he sees her for the first time, he does the whole, like...
And his eyebrows kind of...
Eyebrow, wild. Yeah, the whole, yeah. Like, eyebrow jump when he sees her, like, oh, and that's a little right. bit, like, stop, you know, keep it normal, Kong, don't be creepy.
Yeah, so, you know, I think that, yeah, he has this thing... person that he thinks of as, I don't know, it's just, it's hard to, it's weird if you start delving into it, I guess, but
yeah.
I'm not meant to really think too hard about it, because it's just, yes, exactly, because it's just, you know, he obviously cares about her, and that is what it is. We don't know why, or what his idea is for their relationship, or whatever, because he is an animal, ultimately.
Albeit
an animal of above average intelligence and extreme above average strength, etc.
<It's hard>. Yeah.
But everything that he does for most of the movie is clearly to protect her and save her. And he's much better at that than any of the other male characters in the movie are. And they don't really see all of his efforts to save her as they're
or
trying
misjudge
to save
them
her from him. Right. Exactly. But we see it all as the audience, and so, you know, that makes it hard not to sympathize with him. And ultimately, that's what he's trying to do at the end when he breaks free. That's kind of what motivates him to free himself in New York City, is that he thinks she's in danger. And he's just trying to get away from all of the dangers of the modern world.
And those flashing bulbs are the worst. Paparazzis.
They are. The worst. They are. So, yeah.
Are there any other themes that sort of rise to the top for you?
Well, I don't know if this is a theme per se, but definitely the contrast in the final act of the movie when he's in New York City, out of his element. You know, we've seen him, like, he is King Kong. He is the king of that island.
Skull Island. Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, he's the baddest thing on the island, and there are a lot of bad things, and he can beat them all up and beat them all into submission or whatever. And then they carry him back to civilization. And, you know, I think it's so great that they have him, you know, climb the Empire State Building, which, you know, this is 1933. The Empire State Building was completed in 1931. So it's this brand new, and it was the tallest building in the world at the time, remained the tallest building in the world for a few decades. And you know, it's kind of the newest, brightest symbol of human kind of might and achievement, and it's got that name, the Empire State Building. And he climbs to the top of it, and you've got the airplanes flying around shooting at him, which, again, just such a very modern thing for the times. I don't know. I think it's really hard for us now to get the sense from watching that the audiences at the time would have, because it looks so dated and old, and 30s to us. But at the time, that was just like, I don't know. You have to imagine that most of the people watching this movie across America would have never even imagined a building as huge as the Empire State Building.
Like, would have wanted to get a confirmation that one that big actually was around.
Or whatever, yeah. Or like, you know, that they wouldn't have seen a lot of airplanes even, or, you know, etc.
Yeah.
So I think that the movie is very exciting on that level. And it's just, there's definitely this contrast between kind of Kong's natural primordial might and the might of civilization, basically of human civilization and technology, which ultimately wins out. And that really, the fact that it wins out is what turns Kong into a sympathetic underdog by the end, I suppose. Because we do love an underdog.
He is a funny sort of underdog, though, because...
Well, he's certainly not an underdog on Skull Island.
No, but yeah, exactly. Yeah, he's a single-minded...
he's the alpha male.
Alpha male character. You know, he's not used to... is not accustomed to anything being capable of being a threat, really.
Right.
And yet these little, like, gnats with machine guns end up being his undoing.
But just what a great image, him climbing the building and being completely dwarfed by this massive structure. The first thing in the movie that he doesn't dwarf, but the other way around. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah that's
he's
true.
He's so much bigger than everything else, and then the Empire State Building is just... massive compared to him. It's the sense of scale that you get from that is really cool.
That's a good thought. Well, and it has to be one of the, I mean, it's a landmark image, like the image of King Kong on top of the Empire State Building just as like in the cultural consciousness.
I was reading last night that for the 50th anniversary of the movie in 1983, They had like a 50-foot tall inflatable Kong that they attached to the top of the Empire State Building.
Whoa!
I need to find a picture of that.
So awesome! Yeah, I mean, I want to go look that up right now. Go look that up right now, listeners. Yeah.
So yeah, very cool. Very cool.
Awesome.
But yeah, you're right. It's a landmark image and a landmark film that I think not enough people probably have seen. You know, everybody knows. It's a cultural touchstone. Everybody knows about it. And I think that far too few people have actually sat down and watched the original version. And if you think that you know, or you're like, oh, I get the idea, or I've seen the Peter Jackson version, I get the idea. No, don't do that. go watch the 1933 one.
Yeah, and...
which I did end up showing in that class, incidentally.
What did your high schoolers think of it?
to a group of 10th graders. And as with most of the movies that we show, this was one of the, I think this was the, actually the first movie that I showed them that we watched all the way through. We watched a few excerpts of earlier movies, but this was the full first full-length one we watched. And, you know, they were a little distracted at first, definitely laughing a little bit. But certainly by the time Kong had been on screen for even just a couple of minutes, like there was a little giggling when he first walked in, totally understandable. But just like me, you know, by the end of the movie, they had forgotten that they were watching a special effect. Like, he had become a fully realized character, you know, kind of a living, breathing being, and you know, their sympathy was with him, too. This was a few years ago, but still, you know, I think that it has had that staying power for audiences of all ages. It just really works.
Yeah, I mean, if they can have that effect on high schoolers past 2000, period.
the most jaded people on earth, the American.
Yes, pretty much. Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, and I'm glad to have seen it. Like a lot of the movies that we end up watching in preparation for this podcast, you know, if Peter Jackson's movie just like creates that sort of impetus for someone chasing down the original, like, that's a good enough reason for it to exist, I would say.
Sure, sure. Just to more awareness or whatever. Fine.
Yeah.
I can buy that.
As always, thanks so much, guys, for joining us for this episode of the Movie Goings podcast. I've been Micah. He's been Jared.
Still am.
And we'll be excited to see you guys again soon.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Sorry, buddy. Show's over.